pyramidal, and shaped and notched in the center. And the temple imitates the mountain's shape, intensifies it, clarifies it, geometricizes it, and therefore makes it more potent, as if to draw water down from the mountain to the fields below. Imitate, make it geometrical, intensify. That is not a bad three-part formula for the driving pulse of the arts as a whole. Somehow innovators know how it all is to be done. They select images from nature that are emotionally and aesthetically potent. In the course of history, as techniques grew more sophisticated, the artists projected feelings back out to nature. Those in architecture and the visual arts created designs based on the idealized features of the human body and what they imagined to be gods modeled from the human body. Supplication, reverence, love, grief, triumph, and majesty, all emotion-charged constructions of the human mind, were captured as abstract images and forced onto both living and inanimate landscapes. Artists, while free-ranging in the details selected, generally remain faithful to the innate universals of aesthetics. In his 1905 to 1908 variations of The Farm Weltevreden at Diefendrecht, the young Piet Mondrian depicted a row of spindly trees in front of a shadowy house. The spacing of the tree trunks seems intuitively right. The redundancy in the canopy lacework is close to what, as I will describe shortly, modern EEG monitoring suggests is most arousing to the brain. The arrangement of open space and water nearby are those that recent psychological studies have revealed to be innately among the most attractive out of all such possible arrangements. Unaware of these neurobiological correlates, probably uncaring even if he had been told, Mondrian repeated the tree row theme many times over a 10-year period as he felt his way toward new forms of expression. With the influences of Vermeer and Van Gogh put well behind him, he discovered and experimented with cubism. In Study of Trees 2, 1913, the canopies of several trees are brought forward, dominating fences and other skeletonized and unfocused structures, yet all still balanced in composition and close to optimally complex by measure of brain arousal. Other variations of the same period increasingly abstract the whole into a maze-like configuration of reticulate lines. The interspaces capture patterns of light and color that change from one compartment to the next. The overall effect is not unlike that of a mottled sky viewed upward through a woodland canopy. Other subjects, including buildings, dunes, piers, and the sea, are similarly transformed. In the end, Mondrian attained the pure abstract designs for which he was to be celebrated. Nothing human, nothing specific, as he put it. In this sense, he liberated his art. But it is not truly free, and I doubt that inwardly he ever wished it to be. It stays true to the ancient hereditary ground rules that define the human aesthetic. We do not see in the evolution of Mondrian a localized production of Western culture. The same process was at work in the confluence of Asian art and writing. Chinese characters were invented 3,000 years ago as crude pictographs resembling the objects they represent. The sun and moon, mountains and rivers, people and animals, dwellings and utensils are all instantly recognizable today in the ancient Chinese script. They, too, approach the optimum level of complexity by EEG standards. Over centuries, the characters evolved into the elegant Koryo calligraphy of standard script. An early version of Koryo, after its introduction to Japan, gave rise to new forms, including the flowing Wayo script unique to that country. As in Western calligraphy and the ornamental initial letters of medieval hand scripts, art imposed on the written word its own aesthetic standards. By intuition alone, and a sensibility that does not submit easily to formulas, artists and writers know how to evoke emotional and aesthetic response, adding one artifice to another, obedient to the dictum, ars est celare artem, it is art to conceal art. They steer us away from explanations of their productions. As Louis Armstrong is reported to have said about jazz, if you have to ask, you'll never know. Scientists, in contrast, try to know. They are anxious to tell you everything and to make it all clear. But they must respectfully wait until the curtain falls or the book covers close. The arts are eternally discursive. They seek maximum effect with novel imagery, and imagery that burns itself into the memory so that when recalled, it retains some of its original impact. Among examples I especially appreciate is the perfect opening of Nabokov's pedophilic novel. Lolita, the tip of the tongue taking a trip of three steps down the palate to tap at three on the teeth. Lolita. Thus, with anatomical accuracy, alliterative T sounds, and poetic meter, Nabokov drenches the name, the book title, and the plot in sensuality. Surprise, wit, and originality characterize the memorable use of metaphor. In another genre, the poet Elizabeth Spires tells us about a theological lesson given by a nun at St. Joseph's Elementary School in Circleville, Ohio, on a snowy winter morning. The subject was eschatology for beginners. How long will those lost souls pay for their sins? For all eternity. Eternity. How can we, at 11 years old, she must be thinking, possibly be able to conceive of just how long eternity is? Imagine the largest mountain in the world, made of solid rock. Once every 100 years, a bird flies past, the tip of its wing brushing lightly against the mountaintop. Eternity is as long as it would take for the bird's wing to wear the mountain down to nothing. Ever after, I connect hell and eternity, not with fire and flames, but with something cold and unchanging. A snowy tundra overshadowed by a huge granite mountain that casts a pall over the landscape. What can we truly know about the creative powers of the human mind? The explanation of their material basis will be found at the juncture of science and the humanities. The first premise of the scientific contribution is that Homo sapiens is a biological species born of natural selection in a biotically rich environment. Its corollary is that the epigenetic rules affecting the human brain were shaped during genetic evolution by the needs of Paleolithic people in this environment. The premise and corollary have the following consequence. Culture, rising from the productions of many minds that interlace and reinforce one another over many generations, expands like a growing organism into a universe of seemingly infinite possibility. But not all directions are equally likely. Before the scientific revolution, every culture was sharply circumscribed by the primitive state of that culture's empirical knowledge. The culture evolved under the local influence of climate, water distribution, and food resources. Less obviously, its growth was profoundly affected by human nature. Which brings us back to the arts. the epigenetic rules of human nature, bias, innovation, learning, and choice. They are gravitational centers that pull the development of mind in certain directions and away from others. Arriving at the centers, artists, composers, and writers over the centuries have built archetypes, the themes most predictably expressed in original works of art. Although recognizable through their repeated occurrence, archetypes cannot be easily defined by a simple combination of generic traits. They are better understood with examples, collected into groups that share the same prominent features. This method, called definition by specification, works well in elementary biological classification, even when the essential nature of the species as a category remains disputed. In myth and fiction, as few as 24 such subjective groupings cover most of the archetypes usually identified as such. Some of the most frequently cited are the following. In the beginning, the people are created by gods, or the mating of giants, or the clash of titans. In any case, they begin as special beings at the center of the world. The tribe emigrates to a promised land, or Arcadia, or the secret valley, or the new world. The tribe meets the forces of evil. In a desperate battle for survival, it triumphs against heavy odds. The hero descends to hell, or is exiled to wilderness, or experiences an Iliad in a distant land. He returns in an odyssey against all odds, past fearsome obstacles along the way, to complete his destiny. The world ends in apocalypse, by flood, fire, alien conquerors, or avenging gods. It is restored by a band of heroic survivors. A source of great power is found in the tree of life, the river of life, philosopher's stone, sacred incantation, forbidden ritual, secret formula. The nurturing woman is apotheosized as the great goddess, the great mother, holy woman, divine queen, Mother Earth, Gaia. The seer has special knowledge and powers of mind available to those worthy to receive it. He is the wise old man or woman, the holy man, the magician, the great shaman. The virgin has the power of purity, is the vessel of sacred strength, must be protected at all costs, and perhaps surrendered up to propitiate the gods or demonic forces. Female sexual awakening is bestowed by the unicorn, the gentle beast, the powerful stranger, the magical kiss. The trickster disturbs established order and liberates passion as the god of wine, king of the carnival, eternal youth, clown, jester, clever fool. A monster threatens humanity, appearing as the serpent demon, Satan writhing at the bottom of hell, dragon, gorgon, golem, vampire. If the arts are steered by inborn rules of mental development, they are end products not just of conventional history, but also of genetic evolution. The question remains, were the genetic guides mere byproducts, epiphenomena of that evolution, or were they adaptations that directly improved survival and reproduction? And if adaptations, what exactly were the advantages conferred? The answers, some scholars believe, can be found in artifacts preserved from the dawn of art. They can be tested further with knowledge of the artifacts and customs of present-day hunter-gatherers. This is the picture of the origin of the arts that appears to be emerging. The most distinctive qualities of the human species are extremely high intelligence, language, culture, and reliance on long-term social contracts. In combination, They gave early Homo sapiens a decisive edge over all competing animal species, but they also exacted a price we continue to pay, composed of the shocking recognition of the self, of the finiteness of personal existence, and of the chaos of the environment. These revelations, not disobedience to the gods, are what drove humankind from paradise. Homo sapiens is the only species to suffer psychological exile. All animals, while capable of some degree of specialized learning, are instinct-driven, guided by simple cues from the environment that trigger complex behavior patterns. The great apes have the power of self-recognition, but there is no evidence that they can reflect on their own birth and eventual death, or on the meaning of existence. The complexity of the universe means nothing to them. They and other animals are exquisitely adapted to just those parts of the environment on which their lives depend, and they pay little or no attention to the rest. The dominating influence that spawned the arts was the need to impose order on the confusion caused by intelligence. In the era prior to mental expansion, the ancestral pre-human populations evolved like any other animal species. They lived by instinctive responses that sustained survival and reproductive success. When Homo-level intelligence was attained, it widened that advantage by processing information well beyond the releaser cues. It permitted flexibility of response and the creation of mental scenarios that reached to distant places and far into the future. The evolving brain, nevertheless, could not convert to general intelligence alone. It could not turn into an all-purpose computer. So, in the course of evolution, the animal instincts of survival and reproduction were transformed into the epigenetic algorithms of human nature. It was necessary to keep in place these inborn programs for the rapid acquisition of language, sexual conduct, and other processes of mental development. Had the algorithms been erased, the species would have faced extinction. The reason is that the lifetime of an individual human being is not long enough to sort out experiences by means of generalized, unchanneled learning. Yet the algorithms were jerry-built, they worked adequately, but not superbly well. Because of the slowness of natural selection, which requires tens or hundreds of generations to substitute new genes for old, there was not enough time for human heredity to cope with the vastness of new contingent possibilities revealed by high intelligence. Algorithms could be built, but they weren't numerous and precise enough to respond automatically and optimally to every possible event. The arts filled the gap. Early humans invented them in an attempt to express and control through magic the abundance of the environment, the power of solidarity, and other forces in their lives that mattered most to survival and reproduction. The arts were the means by which these forces could be ritualized and expressed in a new, simulated reality. They drew consistency from their faithfulness to human nature, to the emotion-guided epigenetic rules, the algorithms of mental development. They achieved that fidelity by selecting the most evocative words, images, and rhythms, conforming to the emotional guides of the epigenetic rules, making the right moves. The arts still perform this primal function, and in much the same ancient way. Their quality is measured by their humanness, by the precision of their adherence to human nature. To an overwhelming degree, that is what we mean when we speak of the true and beautiful in the arts. About 30,000 years ago, Homo sapiens used the visual arts to bring the representation of large animals into shelters. Some of the oldest and most sophisticated of such works are the wall paintings, engravings, and sculptures found in caverns of the southern half of Ice Age Europe. More than 200 such caverns containing thousands of images have been found during the past century in Italy, Switzerland, France, and Spain. The most recently discovered, and oldest of all, is the spectacularly painted cave at Chauvet in the valley of the Ardèche River, a tributary of the Rhône. Chemical tests have established the age of the art at 32,410 plus or minus 720 years. The youngest cave galleries are Magdalenian paintings, etchings, and sculptures created as recently as 10,000 years before the present, near the dawn of the Neolithic era. The best of the animal drawings are accurate and beautiful, even by exacting modern standards. They are rendered with clean, sweeping lines, some of which are shaded to one side as though to convey three-dimensionality. They present a veritable field guide to the largest mammals of the region, from lion to mammoth, bear to horse, rhinoceros to bison, most of which are now extinct. The figures are more than abstract images. Some are clearly male or female, of different ages. A few of the females are swollen with young. Some wear recognizable winter or summer pelages. At Chauvet, two rampant male rhinoceros lock horns in battle. Given the antiquity of Chauvet and the scarcity of even older representational art, it is tempting to conclude that the skills of the cavern artists emerged quickly, perhaps within a few generations, but that would be premature. On the basis of genetic and fossil evidence, it appears that anatomically modern Homo sapiens evolved in Africa by about 200,000 years before the present and entered Europe as recently as 50,000 years ago. In the succeeding interval, up to the time of the Chauvet paintings, they slowly displaced the Neanderthal people, now considered by some anthropologists to be a distinct human species. It is reasonable to suppose that during this era, and before occupying the particular cave sites that today harbor the oldest known works, the artists improved their techniques and style on surfaces now lost. Many of the early paintings might have been applied to outdoor rock walls, a practice still followed by hunter-gatherers in Australia and southern Africa, and as a result, failed to survive the harsh climate of Ice Age Europe. It may never be known whether European cavern art sprang full-blown or was perfected in small steps across millennia, but at least we have strong hints as to why it was created. A number of the examples, as many as 28% at Cosc, near Marseille, for example, are depicted with arrows or spears flying about the bodies of the animals. A bison at Lascaux has been eviscerated by a spear that enters its anus and emerges through its genitals. The simplest and most persuasive explanation for the embellishment is the one proposed in the early 1900s by Abbé Breuil, the pioneer explorer and interpreter of European Paleolithic art. It is hunting magic, he said, the belief that by recreating animals and killing their images, the hunters will more readily overcome real prey when the chase begins outdoors. Art is magic. That has a modern ring, for as we often hear, the purpose of the arts is enchantment. Breuil's hypothesis is supported by an intriguing piece of additional evidence, the repeated depiction of the same animal species on the same rock surface panels. In one case, chemical tests indicate that the portraits were drawn centuries apart. Duplicates are also commonly drawn, or in some cases etched on bone fragments, on top of the original. Rhinoceros horns are replicated, mammoths bear multiple head domes, Lions have two or three complete heads. Although we will never be able to read the minds of the artists, it is a fair guess that they meant the images to be reborn with each duplication in order to serve the purpose of new rituals. Those rituals might have been part of full-blown ceremonies accompanied by early forms of music and dancing. Flutes made of bone have been discovered in the caves in good enough condition to be cleaned and played, and the paintings themselves are consistently located in places where the acoustics are excellent. Hunting sorcery of one form or another has survived in hunter-gatherer societies to the present time. It is a form of sympathetic magic, an expression of the near-universal belief among pre-scientific peoples that the manipulation of symbols and images can influence the objects they represent. Sticking pins in dolls and other practices of malign voodoo are among the most familiar examples from popular culture. Most religious rituals contain elements of sympathetic magic. Children selected for sacrifice to Tlaloc, the Aztec god of rain and lightning, were first forced to shed tears in order to bring raindrops to the Valley of Mexico. Christian baptism takes away the sins of the world. To be cleansed, to be born again, you must be washed in the blood of the Lamb. Belief in astrology and extrasensory perception, particularly psychokinesis, is built from similar elements in the sorcerer's toolkit. The near-universal faith in sympathetic magic of one form or another is easily explained. In a bewildering and threatening world, people reach out for power by any means they can find. Combining art with sympathetic magic is a quite natural way to make that attempt. In opposition to the hunting magic hypothesis, it can be argued that the cave art images served the much simpler purpose of instructing the young. Perhaps it was indeed only a prehistoric Peterson's Field Guide to the large mammals of Pleistocene Europe, but with no more than a dozen species to learn, it remains unclear why the portraits were drawn repetitively on the same panels, or why the skills of hunting could not have been better learned by adolescent apprentices when they accompanied their elders in the field, the method used by hunter-gatherer people today. The magic hypothesis of animal art is reinforced by other forms of behavior displayed by extant Stone Age people. Their hunters are intensely preoccupied with the lives of the big animals around them, especially mammals that can be killed only by tracking or ambush. They are less concerned with smaller species, such as hares and porcupines, that can be snared or dug from burrows. They often impute to their large prey the possession of minds and special powers that project their own fierce human desires. The animals they kill, they sometimes propitiate with ceremony. Hunters of many cultures collect skulls, claws, and skins as trophies to memorialize their own prowess. The totemic animals, invested with supernatural qualities and honored with reverential art, are then used as symbols to bind members of the clan together. Their spirits preside over celebrations of victory and see the people through the dark hours of defeat. They remind each individual of the existence of something greater than himself, something immortal of which he is a part. The totems enforce moderation in dispute, and they soften dissension within the tribe. They are sources of real power. It is not surprising to find that among the few well-rendered human beings in Ice Age art are shamans wearing headgear of stag antlers or the head of a bird or lion. It seems logical that gods in the form of animals ruled the ancient civilizations of the Fertile Crescent and Mesoamerica. Such effects of sympathetic magic radiate out, not just hunter-gatherer bands, but also groups and nations at the level of high civilization are prone to adopt animal species as totems to reflect the qualities they most value in themselves. American football fans, having at last found a way to form their own Paleolithic tribes, cheer for the Detroit Lions, Miami Dolphins, and Chicago Bears. The biological origin of the arts is a working hypothesis, dependent on the reality of the epigenetic rules and the archetypes they generate. It has been constructed in the spirit of the natural sciences, and as such, is meant to be testable, vulnerable, and consilient with the rest of biology. So how, then, is the hypothesis to be tested? One way is to predict from evolutionary theory the themes and underlying epigenetic rules most likely to be encountered in the arts. We know that such near-universal themes do exist, and in fact form the scaffolding of most works of fiction and the visual arts. Their generality is the reason Hollywood plays well in Singapore, and why Nobel Prizes in literature are given to Africans and Asians, as well as to Europeans. What we do not understand very well is why this is so, why processes of mental development direct attention so consistently toward certain images and narratives. Evolutionary theory is a potentially powerful means of predicting the underlying epigenetic rules and understanding their origins in genetic history. Earlier, I described one important example of the evolutionary approach in studies that address incest avoidance and taboos. The inborn inhibitory responses causing these phenomena have reverberated in myth and the arts throughout recorded history. Other responses that can connect biological theory to the arts are parent-infant bonding, family cooperation and conflict, and territorial aggression and defense. A second, wholly different means of discovering epigenetic rules affecting the arts is simply to scan directly for them with methods from the neurosciences and cognitive psychology. In a pioneering study of bioaesthetics published in 1973, the Belgian psychologist Gerda Smets asked subjects to view abstract designs of varying degrees of complexity while she recorded changes in their brainwave patterns. To register arousal, she used the desynchronization of alpha waves, a standard neurobiological measure. In general, the more the alpha waves are desynchronized, the greater the psychological arousal subjectively reported by subjects. Smets made a surprising discovery. She found a sharp peak of brain response when the redundancy, repetitiveness of elements, in the designs was about 20%. This is the equivalent amount of order found variously in a simple maze, in two complete turns of a logarithmic spiral, or in a cross with asymmetrical arms. The 20% redundancy effect appears to be innate. Newborn infants gaze longest at drawings with about the same amount of order. What does this epigenetic rule have to do with aesthetics and art? The connection is closer than may be immediately apparent. Smets' high arousal figures, even though generated by a computer, have an intriguing resemblance to abstract designs used worldwide in friezes, grillwork, logos, colophons, and flag designs. They are also close in order and complexity to the pictographs of written Chinese, Japanese, Thai, Tamil, Bengali, and other Asian languages of diverse origin, as well as the glyphs of the ancient Egyptians and Mayans. Finally, it seems likely that some of the most esteemed products of modern abstract art fall near the same optimal level of order as illustrated in Mondrian's oeuvre. Although this connection of neurobiology to the arts is tenuous, it offers a promising cue to the aesthetic instinct, one that has not, to my knowledge, been explored systematically by either scientists or interpreters of the arts. Analyzing the beauty of a young woman's face is another way to scan directly for epigenetic rules relevant to aesthetics. For more than a century, it has been known that photographic composites of many faces blended together are considered more attractive than most of the individual faces viewed separately. The phenomenon has led to the belief that ideal facial beauty is simply the average condition for the population as a whole. That entirely reasonable conclusion turns out to be only half true. In 1994, new studies revealed that a blend of individual faces considered attractive at the outset is rated higher than a blend of all the faces without prior selection. In other words, an average face is attractive, but not optimally attractive. Certain dimensions of the face are evidently given more weight in evaluation than others. The analyses then produced a real surprise. When the critical dimensions were identified and exaggerated in artificially modified composites, attractiveness rose still more. Both Caucasian and Japanese female faces had this effect on young British and Japanese subjects of both sexes. The features thought most attractive are relatively high cheekbones, a thin jaw, large eyes relative to the size of the face, and a slightly shorter rather than longer distance between mouth and chin and between nose and chin. Only a small percentage of young women fall at or close to the average. That is to be expected in a genetically diverse species whose precise combinations of features are created anew within and between families of every generation. What is more puzzling is the divergence of the optimum from the average. Few women, extremely few in fact, approach it. If the perception of facial beauty resulted in the higher survival and reproductive success of the most beautiful conceivable, then the most beautiful should be at or close to the average within the population. Such is the expected result of stabilizing natural selection. Deviations from the optimum dimensions in any direction are disfavored, and the optimum is sustained as the norm through evolutionary time. The explanation for the rarity of great beauty may be, and I continue to speculate, the behavioral phenomenon known as the supernormal stimulus. Widespread among animal species, it is the preference during communication for signals that exaggerate the norms, even if they rarely, if ever, occur in nature. An instructive example is female attractiveness in the silver-washed fritillary, a silver-dappled orange butterfly found in woodland clearings from Western Europe to Japan. During the breeding season, males instinctively recognize females of their own species by their unique color and flight movements. They chase them, but they are not what the males really prefer. Researchers found that they could attract male fritillaries with plastic replicas whose wings are flapped mechanically. To their surprise, they also learned that males turn from real females and fly toward the models that have the biggest, brightest, and most rapidly moving wings. No such fritillary superfemale exists in the species' natural environment. Males of the silver-washed fritillary appear to have evolved to prefer the strongest expression of certain stimuli they encounter with no upper limit. The phenomenon is widespread in the animal kingdom. While experimenting with Anole lizards of the West Indies a few years ago, I found that males display enthusiastically to photographs of other members of the same species, even though the images are the size of a small automobile. Other researchers have learned that herring gulls ignore their own eggs when presented with appropriately painted wooden models so large they cannot even climb on top of them. In the real world, the supernormal response works because the monstrous forms created by experimenters do not exist, and the animals can safely follow an epigenetic rule expressible as follows. Take the largest, or brightest, or most conspicuously moving individual you find. Female fritillaries cannot be gigantic insects with brilliant whirring wings. Such creatures could not locate enough food to get through the caterpillar stage and survive in the Eurasian woodlands. In parallel manner, women with large eyes and delicate features may have less robust health, especially during the rigors of childbearing, than those closer to the population average. But at the same time, and this could be the adaptive significance, they present physical cues of youth, virginity, and the prospect of a long reproductive period. The off-center optimum of female attractiveness is no more peculiar than most of the rest of human social behavior. The entire beauty industry can be interpreted as the manufacture of supernormal stimuli. Eyelid shadow and mascara enlarge the eyes. Lipstick fills out and brightens the lips. Rouge brings a permanent blush to the cheeks. Pancake makeup smooths and reshapes the face toward the innate ideal. Fingernail paint adds blood circulation to the hands, and teasing and tinting render the hair full-bodied and youthful. All these touches do more than imitate the natural physiological signs of youth and fecundity. They go beyond the average normal. The same principle is true for body adornment of all kinds in men and women. Clothing and emblems project vigor and advertise status. Thousands of years before artists painted animals and costumed shamans on the cave walls of Europe, people were fastening beads onto clothing and piercing belts and headbands with carnivore teeth. Such evidence indicates that the original canvas of the visual arts was the human body itself. Ellen Dissanayake, an American historian of aesthetics, suggests that the primal role of the arts is, and always has been, to make special particular features of humans, animals, and the inanimate environment. Such features, as illustrated by feminine beauty, are the ones toward which human attention is already biologically predisposed. They are among the best places to search for the epigenetic rules of mental development. The arts, while creating order and meaning from the seeming chaos of daily existence, also nourish our craving for the mystical. We are drawn to the shadowy forms that drift in and out of the subconscious. We dream of the insoluble, of unattainably distant places and times. Why should we so love the unknown? The reason may be the Paleolithic environment in which the brain evolved. In our emotions, I believe we are still there. As a naturalist, I use an explicit geographic imagery in reveries of this formative world. At the center of our world is home ground. In the center of the center are shelters backed against a rock wall. From the shelters radiate well-traveled paths where every tree and rock is familiar. Beyond lies opportunity for expansion and riches. Down a river, through a wooded corridor lining the opposite shore, are campsites in grassy places where game and food plants are seasonally abundant. Such opportunities are balanced by risk. We might lose our way on a too distant foray. A storm can catch us. Neighboring people, poisoners, cannibals, not fully human, will either trade or attack. We can only guess their intentions. In any case, they are an impassable barrier. On the other side is the rim of the world, perhaps glimpsed as a mountain front or a drop toward the sea. anything could be out there. Dragons, demons, gods, paradise, eternal life. Our ancestors came from there. Spirits we know live closer by, and at fall of night are on the move. So much is intangible and strange. We know a little, enough to survive, but all the rest of the world is a mystery. What is this mystery we find so attractive? It is not a mere puzzle waiting to be solved. It is far more than that, something still too amorphous, too poorly understood to be broken down into puzzles. Our minds travel easily, eagerly, from the familiar and tangible to the mystic realm. Today, the entire planet has become home ground. Global information networks are its radiating trails. But the mystic realm has not vanished. It has just retreated, first from the foreground and then from the distant mountains. Now we look for it in the stars, in the unknowable future, in the still teasing possibility of the supernatural. Both the known and the unknown, the two worlds of our ancestors, nourish the human spirit. Their muses, science and the arts, whisper, "Follow us, explore, find out." In trying to comprehend this aura of the ancestral mind, we are not entirely dependent on introspection and fantasy. Anthropologists have carefully studied bands of contemporary hunter-gatherers whose life ways appear to resemble those of our common Paleolithic forebears. In recording languages, daily activities, and conversations, the researchers have drawn reasonable inferences concerning the thought processes of their subjects. One such account has been provided by Louis Liebenberg on the Sand-speaking Bushman hunter-gatherers of the Central Kalahari. More particularly, the Juwasi, or Kong, Gwi, and Sho of Botswana and Namibia. He has drawn on his own researches and those of other anthropologists, most prominently Richard B. Lee and George B. Silberbauer, to record the vanishing culture of these remarkable people. The Kalahari bands, in order to live on the sparse resources of the desert, must plan and act very carefully. Knowledge of the local terrain and of seasonal ecology is particularly important. The bands understand that the distribution of water resources within their territory is most important of all. In Liebenberg's words, "During the rainy season, they live at temporary pools in the midst of nut forests. Only the most palatable and abundant foods that are the least distance from water are collected. As time goes on, they have to travel further and further to collect food. They usually occupy a camp for a period of weeks or months and eat their way out of it. During the dry season, groups are based at permanent water holes. They eat out an increasing radius of desirable foods, and as the water-food distances increase, the subsistence effort increases." The Kalahari bands are experts on local geography and the many plants and animals on which their lives depend. Plant gatherers, usually women, but also men on their way home from unsuccessful hunts, use knowledge of the botanical communities to pinpoint edible species. They are conservationists by way of necessity. Liebenberg continues, "They avoid stripping an area of a species, leaving a residue so that regeneration is not imperiled. Locally scarce specimens are not exploited, even when these are found while gathering other species." The hunters are also equally expert on the details of animal life. Their skills at tracking large animals depend on this knowledge. When fresh spoor is found, hunters will estimate its age and how fast the animal was moving to decide whether it is worth following up. In thick bush, where there may be no clear footprints, or on hard ground, where only scuff marks may be evident, trackers may not be able to identify the animal. When this happens, they will have to follow the trail, looking for signs such as disturbed vegetation and scuff marks, until clear footprints are found. They will reconstruct what the animal was doing and predict where it was going. In the Kalahari, as throughout all of the hunter-gatherer world for countless millennia, the hunt holds a central place in the social life of the band. In storytelling around the campfire at night, men give graphic descriptions of hunts of the recent and distant past. To find animals requires all the information on their movements that can be gained from others' observations and the hunter's own interpretation of signs. Hunters will spend many hours discussing the habits and movements of animals. The life of the Kalahari band, optimally comprising 50 to 70 members, is intensely communal and cooperative. Because the group must move several times a year with all their possessions on their backs, individuals accumulate few material goods not essential to survival. Ownership is limited to an individual's clothing, a man's weapons and implements, and a woman's household goods. The band's territory and all its assets are not owned individually, but communally, by the whole band. To hold the group together, decorum and reciprocity are strictly observed. While hunting is an important activity in hunter-gatherer subsistence, successful hunters, who may naturally be pleased with themselves, are expected to show humility and gentleness. To the Juwasi, for example, announcing a kill is a sign of arrogance and is strongly discouraged. Many good hunters do no hunting for weeks or months at a time. After a run of successful hunts, a hunter will stop hunting in order to give other men the chance to reciprocate. While the Kalahari hunters are close students of animal behavior, they are thoroughly anthropomorphic in their interpretation. They strain to enter the minds of the animals they track. They imagine, they project thoughts directly to the world around them, and they analogize. Animal behavior is perceived as rational and directed by motives based on values, or the negation of those values, that are either held by the hunter-gatherers themselves or by people known to them. The behavior of animals is seen by the Gwi as bound by the natural order of En-Adima, God. Each species is perceived to have characteristic behavior, which is governed by its shoshudzi, customs, and each has its particular shoisa, speech, language. Animals are believed to have acquired special capabilities by means of rational thought. Knowing the belief of pre-literate people in the equivalency of the material and immaterial worlds, and of rational and irrational explanation, it is easy to see how they invent narrative forms loaded with myths and totems. The acceptance of mystery is central to their lives. The Gwi believe that some species possess knowledge that transcends that of humans. The battler eagle is believed to know when a hunter will be successful and will hover over him, thereby acting as an omen of sure success. Some steenbok are thought to have a magical means of protecting themselves from a hunter's arrows, while the duiker is believed to practice sorcery against its animal enemies and even against conspecific rivals. Baboons, because of their legendary love of trickery and teasing, are believed to eavesdrop on hunters and to pass on their plans to the intended prey animals. The world that pre-literate humans factually perceive is only a small fragment of the full natural world. Thus, by necessity, the primitive mind is continuously tuned to mystery. For the Kalahari and other contemporary hunter-gatherers, the experience of daily life grades imperceptibly into their magical surroundings. Spirits dwell in trees and rocks, animals think, and human thought projects outward from the body with a physical force. We are all still primitives compared to what we might become. Hunter-gatherers and college-educated urbanites alike are aware of fewer than 1 in 1,000 of the kinds of organisms, plants, animals, and microorganisms that sustain the ecosystems around them. They know very little about the real biological and physical forces that create air, water, and soil. Even the most able naturalist can trace no more than a faint outline of an ecosystem to which he has devoted a lifetime of study. Yet the great gaps in knowledge are beginning to be filled. That is the strength of cumulative science in a literate world. People learn and forget. They die, and even the strongest institutions they erect deteriorate. But knowledge continues to expand globally while passing from one generation to the next. Any trained person can retrieve and augment any part of it. By this means, all the species of organisms in ecosystems such as the Kalahari Desert will eventually come to be known. They will be given scientific names. Their place in the food web will be discovered, their anatomy and physiology penetrated to the level of cell and molecule, the instinctive behavior of the animals reduced to neuron circuitry, then to neurotransmitters and ion exchange. If the history of biology is a guide, all the facts will prove consilient. The explanations can be joined in space from molecule to ecosystem, and in time, from microsecond to millennium. With consilient explanation, the units at different levels of biological organization can be reassembled. Among them will be whole plants and animals as we normally see them, not as collections of molecules in biochemical time, too small and fast changing to be visible to the unaided eye, not as whole populations living in the slow motion of ecological time, but as individual plants and animals confined to the sliver of organismic time where human consciousness, being organismic itself, is forced to exist. Returning to that narrow sliver after the science-led grand tour of space-time, we arrive home in the world for which the evolution of the brain prepared us. Now, with science and the arts combined, we have it all. Poet in my heart, walk with me across the mysterious land. We can still be hunters in the million-year dream time. Our minds are filled with calculation and emotion. We are aesthetes tense with anxiety. Once again, the battler eagle wheels above our heads, trying to tell us something we overlooked, something we forgot. How can we be sure that eagles never speak, that everything can be known about this land? Nearby is spoor of the elusive diker leading into the scrub. Shall we follow? Magic enters the mind seductively, like a drug in the veins. Accepting its emotive power, we know something important about human nature, and something important intellectually, that in expanded space-time, the fiery circle of science and the arts can be closed. Within the larger scale, the archaic world of myth and passion is perceived as it truly is, across the full range of cause and effect. Every contour of the terrain, every plant and animal living in it, and the human intellect that masters them all, can be understood more completely as a physical entity. Yet in so doing, we have not abandoned the instinctual world of our ancestors. By focusing on the peculiarly human niche in the continuum, we can, if we wish, and we so desperately wish, inhabit the productions of art with the same sense of beauty and mystery that seized us at the beginning. No barrier stands between the material world of science and the sensibilities of the hunter and the poet. Chapter 11, Ethics and Religion. Centuries of debate on the origin of ethics come down to this. Either ethical precepts, such as justice and human rights, are independent of human experience, or else they are human inventions. The distinction is more than an exercise for academic philosophers. The choice between the assumptions makes all the difference in the way we view ourselves as a species. It measures the authority of religion, and it determines the conduct of moral reasoning. The two assumptions in competition are like islands in a sea of chaos, immovable, as different as life and death, matter and the void. Which is correct cannot be learned by pure logic. For the present, only a leap of faith will take you from one to the other. But the true answer will eventually be reached by the accumulation of objective evidence. Moral reasoning, I believe, is at every level intrinsically consilient with the natural sciences. Every thoughtful person has an opinion on which of the premises is correct. But the split is not, as popularly supposed, between religious believers and secularists. It is between transcendentalists, those who think that moral guidelines exist outside the human mind, and empiricists, who think them contrivances of the mind. The choice between religious or non-religious conviction and the choice between ethically transcendentalist or empiricist conviction are cross-cutting decisions made in metaphysical thought. An ethical transcendentalist, believing ethics to be independent, can either be an atheist or else assume the existence of a deity. In parallel manner, an ethical empiricist, believing ethics to be a human creation only, can either be an atheist or else believe in a creator deity, though not in a law-giving God in the traditional Judeo-Christian sense. In simplest terms, the option of ethical foundation is as follows. I believe in the independence of moral values, whether from God or not, versus I believe that moral values come from humans alone. God is a separate issue. Theologians and philosophers have almost always focused on transcendentalism as the means to validate ethics. They seek the grail of natural law, which comprises freestanding principles of moral conduct immune to doubt and compromise. Christian theologians, following St. Thomas Aquinas' reasoning in Summa Theologiae, by and large consider natural law to be the expression of God's will. Human beings, in this view, have the obligation to discover the law by diligent reasoning and weave it into the routine of their daily lives. Secular philosophers of transcendental bent may seem to be radically different from theologians, but they are actually quite similar, at least in moral reasoning. They tend to view natural law as a set of principles so powerful as to be self-evident to any rational person, whatever the ultimate origin. In short, transcendentalism is fundamentally the same whether God is invoked or not. For example, when Thomas Jefferson, following John Locke, derived the doctrine of natural rights from natural law, he was more concerned with the power of transcendental statements than in their divine or secular origin. In the Declaration of Independence, he blended the secular and religious presumptions in one transcendentalist sentence, thus deftly covering all bets. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That assertion became the cardinal premise of America's civil religion, the righteous sword wielded by Lincoln and Martin Luther King, and it endures as the central ethic binding together the diverse peoples of the United States. So compelling are such fruits of natural law theory, especially when the deity is also invoked, that they may seem to place the transcendentalist assumption beyond question, but to its noble successes must be added appalling failures. It has been perverted many times in the past, used, for example, to argue passionately for colonial conquest, slavery, and genocide. Nor was any great war ever fought without each side thinking its cause transcendentally sacred in some manner or other. "Oh, how we hate one another," observed Cardinal Newman, "for the love of God." So perhaps we can do better by taking empiricism more seriously. Ethics, in the empiricist view, is conduct favored consistently enough throughout a society to be expressed as a code of principles. It is driven by hereditary predispositions in mental development. The moral sentiments of the Enlightenment philosophers, causing broad convergence across cultures, while reaching precise form in each culture according to historical circumstance. The codes, whether judged by outsiders as good or evil, play an important role in determining which cultures flourish and which decline. The importance of the empiricist view is its emphasis on objective knowledge. Because the success of an ethical code depends on how wisely it interprets the moral sentiments, those who frame it should know how the brain works and how the mind develops. The success of ethics also depends on the accurate prediction of the consequence of particular actions as opposed to others, especially in cases of moral ambiguity. That, too, takes a great deal of knowledge consilient with the natural and social sciences. The empiricist argument, then, is that by exploring the biological roots of moral behavior and explaining their material origins and biases, we should be able to fashion a wiser and more enduring ethical consensus than has gone before. The current expansion of scientific inquiry into the deeper processes of human thought makes this venture feasible. The choice between transcendentalism and empiricism will be the coming century's version of the struggle for men's souls. Moral reasoning will either remain centered in idioms of theology and philosophy, where it is now, or it will shift toward science-based material analysis. Where it settles will depend on which worldview is proved correct, or at least which is more widely perceived to be correct. The time has come to turn the cards face up. Ethicists, scholars who specialize in moral reasoning, are not prone to declare themselves on the foundations of ethics or to admit fallibility. Rarely do you see an argument that opens with the simple statement, "This is my starting point, and it could be wrong." Ethicists instead favor a fretful passage from the particular into the ambiguous, or the reverse, vagueness into hard cases. I suspect that almost all are transcendentalists at heart, but they rarely say so in simple declarative sentences. One cannot blame them very much. It is difficult to explain the ineffable, and they evidently do not wish to suffer the indignity of having their personal beliefs clearly understood. So by and large, they steer around the foundation issue altogether. That said, I will, of course, try to be plain about my own position. I am an empiricist. On religion, I lean toward deism, but consider its proof largely a problem in astrophysics. The existence of a cosmological God who created the universe, as envisioned by deism, is possible and may eventually be settled, perhaps by forms of material evidence not yet imagined, or the matter may be forever beyond human reach. In contrast, and of far greater importance to humanity, the existence of a biological God, one who directs organic evolution and intervenes in human affairs, as envisioned by theism, is increasingly contravened by biology and the brain sciences. The same evidence, I believe, favors a purely material origin of ethics, and it meets the criterion of consilience. causal explanations of brain activity and evolution, while imperfect, already cover the most facts known about moral behavior with the greatest accuracy and the smallest number of freestanding assumptions. While this conception is relativistic, in other words, dependent on personal viewpoint, it need not be irresponsibly so. If evolved carefully, it can lead more directly and safely to stable moral codes than transcendentalism, which is also, when you think about it, ultimately relativistic. And yes, lest I forget, I may be wrong,